Session number 9856.
Mr. Morgan, reel two.
Unfortunately, I had an attack of tonsillitis, and I had to remain on the farm while the others went off in lorries. Sorry, they went on foot to the bottom of the valley where they caught lorries, camiones. I then had a most lovely drink given to me, which was coffee with a raw egg beaten up. I've always thought the most wonderful drink something like nectar. But despite that, I've never yet produced the same drink at home. I'm afraid that my memory of it would be confounded. It's like reading about the Golden Road to Samarkand and all about Uzbekistan. Lovely sounding names, but when you get there, you find them a flea-bitten village full of filth. And I'd rather retain that memory rather than disabuse myself. Well, the following day or the day after, I was taken down I walked on the mountain, then in a lorry, and taken to a place, I can't remember the name of it now. Ah, yes, Guernica, the place painted by Picasso, and where the Nazis obliterated in a bombing attack. We are there in some sort of building, whether a church or a barracks, I don't know. And there we stayed a few days.
Was there any sign of bombing when you were there?
No, none at all. It was quite a peaceful village when I got there. It was clearly far from the fighting area. Although I must admit I don't know where the fighting was going on, except I knew it was near Madrid. And there we had some training with rifle shooting, crawling with a rifle, but that's about all.
What kind of weapons did they have?
An ordinary gun, apparently a Russian rifle. And I remember them telling me it shot high to the right. So when you're shooting, you had to make allowance for that. But if the bayonet was on, then it shot accurately. All this now is very vague. Then I remember traveling in buses to another place. I came to a yard where people were gathered around a fire, and we were all given a packet of cigarettes, beautifully tailor-made, as they said. As contrasted with homemade cigarettes. But all the cigarettes were made of straw and quite impossible to smoke. Then my memories are very vague after that. I remember sleeping on the mountain in blankets, sleeping in the snow, learning to sleep in the snow and keep warm by pulling snow over the blanket, which became a sort of eiderdown. But where on earth this was, I don't know.
What were your first impressions of Spain?
Ah, yes.
Was it what you expected?
Well, we weren't really seeing much of Spain. We were either in the building or out in the field training, or away from the towns and away from the villages. I think the closest contact I had was on one occasion when we were on the train nearing Barcelona, when Spaniards came along and gave us some wonderful Spanish origins, small and beautifully sweet. There's nothing really notable about it.
Did the people seem welcoming, those that you met?
Oh, very welcoming, yes. All cheering, all raising their clenched fists, give a welcome. It appeared to me that the International Brigade was idealized by the Spanish loyalists, because they knew that they were fighting the combined forces of Hitler and Mussolini.
Did you ever come across Spaniards who showed hostility or indifference?
No, we didn't come across many people at all. Another memory I have We're given our pay, I think it was about 6 pesetas. I'm not sure how much that was. And I went in the village to buy some oranges. I think I bought a peseta's worth. And I thought I'd have 3 or 4 to put in my pocket. But to my astonishment, he gave me possibly about 40 or 50 oranges, which I then put in my jacket, took my jacket off and wrapped them up in my jacket. Then I remember another occasion doing guard duty in the village. And it's a job I hated, doing nothing at all. I think there's no worse punishment than having nothing to do.
Was there any real need to mount a guard?
Probably not. Unless they were aware of Franco's claim that he had a fifth column in Spain helping him. So I wouldn't know about the real need for it.
Did you ever come across signs of a fifth column in Spain at any time?
Later on, I think. Which I'll mention later. But at the time, no, nothing at all. Very uneventful when you're in the villages. Nowhere near the fascists. And then I remember up in the mountains, we'd be there, and at night time they'd have their campfires shining from all the hills around. And I remember the singing, the tune of Red River Valley. You know, the one home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play.
Yes.
Well, we had that tune, but I think we had our own words for it. I think they went, there's a valley in Spain called Jarama. It's a place that we all know so well, for it was there that we gave of our manhood and where most of our brave comrades fell. Now, Edwin Greening was in the Jarama operation. Did he tell you that?
No, I think that he said that he was there afterwards.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I remember, I was a teetotaler, of course, like the family, all my family. Not even sherry passed our lips, as they say. But we were given some brandy every night to go to sleep, to help us sleep in the mountain. This, of course, was when we had not in actual action, but when we'd been withdrawn from the lines. Much of all this is a blur. I have no clear pattern of movement at all. And you mentioned now this business of any sign of a fifth column. Well, we got up one morning very early before dawn. We were to march to the front to replace a division that was returning. This was near a place called Calatheite. C-A-L-C-E-I-T-E, Calatheite. We marched forward, simply infantry, on two single lines on the edge of the road. I was in the second company, the machine gun company. We marched for some time, maybe an hour or two. And the first company had gone up and round a bend in the hill. And then we heard some shots. The next thing we heard, the shots were being directed at us. So we got off the road into the terraced vineyards. It was only later we discovered what had happened. The first company had gone round the corner and had seen coming towards them armoured cars, armoured tanks, and we knew that our division was returning from the front and we were to relieve them. And company number one thought, well, these were the returning troops. It was only when they were in the middle of them that they realised that the uniform was different. The uniform of the Spanish regular army was, I think, the same uniform worn by both sides. And they both had a star, but one star had 1 point more than the other. which is which, I don't know. I can't remember. And it is only in close inspection they realized that our first company was the enemy and they were surrounded with very few shots. Then, with the firing started with us, we got down into the terraces and set up machine guns and started firing. Normally, the practice in those days was to have Molotov cocktails to burn up the tracks of the tanks and the lorries. But this was much too sudden for anything to be prepared for that sort of attack. All we could do was use the machine guns. Well, the fighting went on for hour after hour, and we in company number two were given the job of trying to halt this convoy while all the other companies retreated backwards. Well, we were able to do this. We were lucky enough to hit a tank somehow or other, which slewed across the road, and they couldn't move it. But inevitably, the men then got up on the hillside and shot down at us with heavier fire than we had. And in the end, there were very few of us left. One chap was badly wounded in his arm and in his knee, and we put him on a stretcher. And for safety's sake, we put him in the culvert that went under the road. His name was Morgan Havard.
Morgan who?
Havard. H-A-V-A-R-D. And we kept them back for some hours, and then we felt it was hopeless. We were only a few of us now. So then we decided to retreat, taking with us Morgan Havard on the stretcher.
Were you all Welshmen in this unit?
Oh no, we were mixed up. I hadn't even known that Morgan Havard was in the unit when I went there. I only knew that subsequently. Then we started retreating in broad daylight. We found it very difficult. By this time we were very thirsty, we had no water, very hungry. And then the planes started coming over to strafe. And it came down quite low. They looked like silver trout, you know, swimming through the water. A lovely sight. And we kept on all that day. And gradually we picked up one or two other people. And by the evening there were about 20 of us all together. So carrying Morgan Havard hadn't been too onerous. But then we wondered how we could continue from that moment onwards. So we held a meeting. It is pointed out to us by people more experienced than ourselves that the terrain we are going to cover was very precipitous, ill-defined, and we couldn't follow the roads. So we'd have to, and also we'd have to travel at night time. If you travelled in daytime, we'd be caught. If you travelled at night time, you had a chance of escaping. But the trouble with Morgan Havard, it'd be almost impossible to carry a stretcher at night time. And later on, I found that to be quite true. We were forever sliding down into a ravine, and we couldn't keep our footing half the time. So we couldn't make up our mind what to do about Morgan Havard. So we made a decision. We couldn't obviously abandon a comrade. At the same time, it would be ridiculous to risk the lives of 20 men for the sake of one. So the matter was put to Morgan Havard. Explained to him what the problem was. And without hesitation, he said, "All you go on, leave me on the roadside in the stretcher, under the shade of a tree if possible, with cigarettes." And he would stay there, wounded though he was. Then we just carried on marching.
Did you ever find out what happened to him?
Yes, we did. That'll come later. He was found by the fascists. He was then taken to hospital. His leg was operated upon, but he lost an arm. And eventually he got back to Britain. And he's still alive today. Well, we continued marching at nighttime, resting in daytime. And then the tonsillitis that had plagued me earlier on struck again. And I found myself completely unable to keep up with the rest of them. Because your throat swelled, the tonsils swell up, they fill your throat. You can't talk, you can't drink, you can't do anything. And I just collapsed on the mountainside. And cold though it was, I felt fast asleep. And I woke up feeling better. Then I started myself to go back, marching roughly east. Very interesting things happened there. I saw a small hut in a vineyard, in an olive grove, and smoke coming out the chimney. So I thought I could go there and get some help from the peasant. But when I got there, it was empty. So I then started looking around for food and eventually found a piece of bread about 2 inches square, dirty and rock hard. I went to the stream, dipped a corner of the bread into the water and then sucked it. It really was like nectar. It was the sweetest thing I'd ever tasted in my life. Amazingly sweet. And then I snapped off little bits of the bread and let it stay in my mouth while it gradually softened and spread a delicious taste through my whole mouth. And that hour or so that I spent there was absolutely delicious, like many a lovely hour I spent by a stream, just listening, looking at the scenery, and reciting poetry to myself. Then I finished it and I carried on. But by this time, I'd probably been about a week without food, apart from this one little bit of bread. And I remember coming to the brow of a hill, and looking down, I saw a farm, the farmyard, which looked remarkably like any farm you find in England or Wales, with a hedge round it and a fence and the sound of dogs barking. But as I walked down the hill, I could hear the shoo-shoo-shoo of bullets going past me. And then I crawled down carefully, and when I came toward the bottom, there was no farm. There was no hedge, no barking dogs, no railings. I then moved back up the hill, crawling, the bullets still coming down, and I could see the farm again. Well, by this time, it becoming clear to me. I must have been mentally affected, otherwise I wouldn't have been moving upwards towards the shots. Well, I could have been killed. And, of course, the farm was a delusion. And I was reminded of the Old Testament, where the prophets of old would spend so many days in the wilderness, and there they see visions and see burning bushes and have contact with spirits and all sorts of sights. Well, I knew it was either a mirage or a mental aberration. So I just continued my way, knowing I would never see this farm, which was too English-looking anyway. And then I finally came into a hill, looked down one evening, and I saw an encampment with horses by a stream and soldiers. I approached in the deepening dusk until I could get near them. And they all seemed to be speaking a sort of Spanish, not good Spanish, but Spanish, the sort of Spanish we had in the battalion. And then I saw the uniform like ours, and a star, and I went up to them with a cigarette, and I said, Dame Fuego, could I have a light, please? No, give me a light. I sat down on the fire and had a meal with them, then went in the tent to sleep, and when I woke up next morning, I was captured. These were fascists, and I don't think they'd realized who I was until they saw this star on my uniform, which again was either 5 or 6 pointed. I was then taken to another place.
Could I just interrupt you and ask you about that long journey of yours? You'd gone many days without food, have
you? Yes, about a week.
And why had you separated from your comrades?
Well, I'd fallen out because of tonsillitis. They'd gone on without realizing I'd stopped. I was the last man. And they'd just gone on.
And had you not even been able to find fruit in the fields?
There was no fruit. I'd tried to find olives, but presumably it was the wrong time of the year for them. This would be early now in 1938, you see. From January to about, well, the beginning of the year. Well, you don't have food that time of the year, do you?
No.
I'd looked for olives, but couldn't find any, you know. And I was up in the hills, away from the villages, away from the towns. So I had no food.
Was this a Spanish unit or a foreign unit that you'd run into?
A Spanish unit. And then they took me to another place, and and my throat was still very, very bad. And my Spanish was very halting. And when they cross-questioned me, I found it very difficult to talk. And I remember saying to them, pointing to my throat, and saying, mala garganta, which I thought meant bad throat. And they were all highly delighted to think that I didn't put the adjective after the noun, but in front.
Which way should it have been?
Oh, in Romance languages, the adjective comes after the noun, apart from a few exceptions, you know. And then they took my glasses off me. That made it very difficult for me to see. They searched me and they found in my pocket a very small metal shaving kit, which had been bought in Woolworth some time ago for perhaps about sixpence or a shilling. It is neatly contrived and took up very little room, but they were convinced that it was of silver for some reason. They also found a university diary in my pocket. Now, the Spaniards were so utterly poor that they knew that anyone who could afford a silver shaving kit must be very wealthy. And even more so when I was able to go to university. Up until 10 years ago in Spain, only the well-to-do could send their children to a grammar school. And even then, they would have to be doing moonlighting jobs as well. I remember one assistant I had in a grammar school who was Spaniard, and his father was a doctor with 5 children, and in order to afford to keep them in school, he had to do other jobs as well in the evening. And the local school always has a contract with the booksellers, so that if you had a second child going to the school, he couldn't have the use of his elder brother's books, because the textbooks were changed every year. guaranteeing a good continued sale of these textbooks. Anyway, they then felt that I should not be shot, and up until this date, all prisoners had been shot by the Francoists. I then taken to a different place.
How in general had they treated you? Roughly or not?
No, not roughly, no. Not roughly. Not kindly, but not roughly. In the sense they took my glasses away. And I had to sleep out of doors with no sort of shelter at all. So roughly, but not kindly. That's all I can say. I can't even remember whether they gave me food or not. I don't know. Possibly if they had, I couldn't have eaten it with tonsillitis.
What impression did you get of their troops as compared with the troops you've been operating with from a military point of view?
Well, these people there seemed very ordinary people, ordinary Spanish peasants. Possibly they were sort of non-combatants. I don't think the Spanish troops loyal to Franco did much fighting. I think mostly it was the Germans, Italians, and the Moors who did the fighting for them, not the ordinary peasant. And my later contacts with these peasants indicated that they really had no political interest in fighting the war. Then I was taken in a car, accompanied by a soldier, and they take my cigarettes away from me, and I was always an inveterate smoker. So this chap was smoking, didn't offer me one. So I think I'd... That's right.